in His Son, and the need for us to understand that, be aware of it, and be able to express it to others. And tonight, I'm going to focus more on some past times, some small experiences that I've had, and personal experiences that I've had with you a couple times. And also from yesterday, I had a little feedback, and person thoughtfully wrote down some things. So one of the points he was making up was sometimes. We hear a Prabhupada said story, our antidote, and maybe questionable whether Prabhupada really said it or not. And that's not something that just recently happened. That was going on even when Prabhupada was present and was addressed a few times by him. He'd usually ask, where did you hear that? So that's always the case. If you hear something that doesn't click with what you've known from your studies, you can always ask, can you give me a reference? That's one way to address the issue. It also in here mentioned somewhere about some of the devotee, I guess recently, had given a lecture discussing Prabhupada's identity, meaning his spiritual identity or spiritual swarup, which is not a topic that Srila Prabhupada himself discussed ever in a public, or even very, very, very rarely, almost nil in a private situation. And in fact, I can say I was present on two of the situations, on one of the situations, and then quite close to the person in the second situation. And in one way they contradict each other, one another, and in another way they don't. But one devotee had asked Srila Prabhupada about his spiritual identity, and Prabhupada flatly said, that you don't need to know. And so then there's been a discussion recently actually on this topic, and this was brought up. You can find this in the folio. The story is being recounted by Prisiputra Prabhu Vyas Maharaj, who's now departed. But he was recounting the story. He was there when the person asked. And so then a devotee said, well, okay, maybe he said that then, but maybe, did he mean that forever? Was it an absolute statement? But if he didn't, from my point of view, Prabhupada wanted us to discuss this later. He would have said that you don't need to know now, or that you can discuss this later. He would have indicated that the timing was off. But that's not what happened. He said that you do not need to know. End of discussion, and it was never discussed again. So I think that most of us can safely say that we were not born pure devotees and that we've come from very conditioned backgrounds. Even those of you from India, will have to admit that you've come with a certain level of conditioning. So what is really the need of knowing Prabhupada's spiritual identity? Even we know, because it's written in different books by the Goswamis, we know the identity of some of the Goswamis and others. Isn't it? But what does that change about us? We just happen to know it. We can, like little parents say, so-and-so was such and such. But, what does it change about our life? Because we're really not to that advanced stage. However, this is a personal observation and understanding, is that on another occasion, Srila Prabhupada was asked whether we would recognize him when we went back home, back to Godhead, because at least we understood that maybe he might, maybe he would be someone else or in another form, another feature. So would we recognize you, Srila Prabhupada, when we go back home? Prabhupada said, yes. You'll recognize everyone. We'll all be there. So that he admonished one disciple for asking that question and said, you don't need to know, doesn't mean we'll never know. When we go back home back to Godhead, it'll become very clear. And in that particular surrounding, that knowledge will be very meaningful because we'll also be part of the picture and interacting on that, you know, same advanced level. But on another, you know, and here's where it's contradictory, but I will also explain this apparent contradiction. In 1967, one Dutch sister wrote a poem about Srila Prabhupada. This is 1967, quite like early Hare Krishna movement. And I was actually going to bring the poem, but I couldn't like get it to copy to my flashback. But it's very simplistic. It's almost childish. And in this poem, the author's name was Harsharani. And in the poem, she was comparing Srila Prabhupada to a cowboy, because at that point, cow herd, we didn't use that term. So if someone was a cow, it was a cowboy. Although in America, a cowboy is normally seen as, you know, a wild west on the horse going after bad guys. But in this context, you know, a cowboy is someone with a cow. And she described him as a cowboy playing with the other cowboys. And she described even what they were playing. They were playing like, it's called leapfrog. One person gets down on the hands and knees, and the other person puts his hands on the back and, you know, leaps over him, and then they go on a chain like this. So it seemed a little childish. Nonetheless, they brought up to Srila Prabhupada, who said, "Primit in Back to Godhead." Now, in Back to Godhead in those days were like this. Pieces of paper stapled together. That was our Back to Godhead. It wasn't such a sophisticated publication. Nonetheless, he took it very seriously, so did we, and, you know, he asked it to be printed. So you can find that also in the folio. So then we were thinking, we were a little surprised the few of us got together. I was there, Upendra was there. I think maybe we'll be in the dust. It was a few of the early San Francisco crew, and we're like, a little like, you know, well, we were thinking this was kind of a childish poem. Prabhupada wants to print it. Maybe there's something there that we're not getting. So we went to him, and we were not coming in an aggressive manner. We were quite innocent. And we asked him, you know, Swamiji, at that point we didn't even, you know, use the term Prabhupada. Swamiji, are you a cowboy? You know, that was, because that was the only way we could see that that poem made any sense. And in a very kind of almost shy way, he said yes, and he didn't go any further. That was it. That's all we needed to know. Then we were satisfied. We didn't go on speculating. We simply accepted that, you know, that he was, you know, then later we could understand Sakura, but, you know, cowboy, he was a cowboy. And we just accepted that very easily, but without making any big deal about it. But later on, as, you know, people became, got a little more sophisticated, so-called, you know, that question, when it was asked about his identity, it wasn't so appropriate. You know, so the innocence, you know, like a little child sense, I mean, like we see in the chapter with Vamanadeva, and he's speaking. And one of the reasons that he is speaking as he is because, you know, it's pointed out, because the child can speak anyway and no one will take offense. You know. So at that point, in 67, we were still very much little children, but then the years went on, we were expected to act our age, and hopefully we had progressed. So that's just in response to the comment. There was some comment about that. I don't think it's really something, I don't normally relate this, although occasionally I do, but it's not something that, you know, you go around and, you know, crack the gong, hey, do you know Prabhupada's the cowherd boy? I mean, it's not really something so appropriate. And then there was another, you know, it says the leader of a temple, somebody had repeated a pastime that's commonly repeated, but the leader of one of that temple declared it was false. But it's not really that it was false. It was just as is so many times. Let's say I tell you something, you tell the next person, it goes around the room. By the time it gets to this person, it's got a slightly different spin. you know, the story there kind of, it's, you know, slightly different after it's gone around the room a bit. So basically that's what happened. Here it was saying that they're obviously talking about in London when he had to have an operation. And what there was apparently, the way it came out was that Prabhupada was supposed to become unconscious. They were giving him an anesthetic, but he wasn't becoming unconscious. So finally the devotee, the doctor was getting frustrated, and finally the devotee said, oh, Prabhupada, you're supposed to become unconscious. And Prabhupada said, oh, is it? And then, you know, why didn't you tell me earlier? And then he was unconscious. So the story has got a little stretched out of context. What did happen from those who were present, and I was also not in the room, but I was present during that situation, was that Prabhupada actually refused the anesthesia and took the operation on the chin, as they say, took it straight. And after, the doctor was completely amazed, because he said even normally patients under anesthesia, they struggle with the procedure, and she was, Prabhupada was very peaceful. So, anyway, but what we should try to keep in context, you know, if we can't get the story straight, at least we can understand Prabhupada was self-controlled. He wasn't bothered by the dictates of the body, and either way you tell the story, that, you know, becomes kind of clear. Yesterday I had mentioned checking the time, because there's one thing I want to bring up before I end. So I was mentioned a little bit how Srila Prabhupada had come to San Francisco for the first time on an airplane. That was, you know, so that, I mean, this is like a historical context, a little history of this son, and he flew from New York to San Francisco. And he was greeted there at the airport by a variety of different types of people. You know, there were people in suits and ties, and you can see this in the early footage, you know, people in suits and ties, and then many of us were coming from the hippie sampradaya, so we were more colorfully dressed. My dog was there, you can see him walking with his little tail in the air. And photo, you know, gentlemen from the newspaper with their big cameras. In those days, they didn't have these little smooth digital cameras. They had great big box cameras with flashes. Allen Ginsberg was there. It was maybe about 50 people. And some of the boys that had come from New York were also there. So when he first came, my personal, you know, experience was, you know, of course we're there, we hadn't, as I said, there were no photographs yet, we hadn't seen him, so we really had nothing to judge, except what we thought he might be looking like, maybe. And as mentioned yesterday, the first, you know, your first impression is that he's not very big. But what happened to myself was that he was coming off the plane, and we were looking and waiting for each, you know, passenger. In fact, when the plane came, we were really excited, and we were all looking in the windows, and we were expecting to see some kind of glow emanating from one of the windows, which would indicate that the Swami was on board. But actually, that wasn't too far off, because when he finally came off the plane, it was more than a glow, it was a blinding flash. I mean, he was definitely effulgent. But so much so, I thought it was from the flash bulbs from the photographers. And my vision was temporarily blinded. And I actually fell to the ground. And I wasn't alone, a few other people did too. And we weren't making obeisances, because we hadn't been taught that, you know, we had been taught to make obeisances yet. We didn't know about them. But this was not an, turns out, if you read accounts of Prabhupada arrivals, it's not such an uncommon occurrence. In Satyananda Maharaj's book, the book on Japa, that he tells about his first meeting with Prabhupada, which was at an airport, and when he came in, it was very bright, and then he found himself on the ground. So, you know, in retrospect myself, I'm looking, well, how did it happen, like, that we ended up on the ground? That I think how we can look at it is we were extremely covered, conditioned souls. That for the first time in our life, a pure devotee who is very effulgent pierced that covering of darkness that was surrounding us. And this was literally shocking. You know, it's just that light that was emanating from him, that purity, that force of purity was coming in contact with the force of ignorance that was surrounding us, and there was like a little collusion that knocked us, and we lost our balance and just fell down. And I don't think that's probably too far off, you know, but I think that's what happens. Just like sometimes you get a glimpse of something momentarily and then it closes up, you know, but sometimes it's like, you know, like a light in the eye. So that glimpse was just so overwhelming. We just went to the ground. So I was on the ground and I was wondering how I got on the ground. And I saw other people were on the ground. Not everybody, but there was, you know, more than me. You know, then I saw my dog walking by. I saw these little feet, little white plastic shoes. And again, a common theme, a common current gliding by. Prabhupada, you know, like we're walking, clump, clump, clump. You know, you can probably hear our feet in the sand. We just walk so heavily. I mean, actually, yesterday evening, I was walking quickly from Prabhupada Samadhi to the gate with my bare feet. And I realized I could hear my feet on the, you know, and I was thinking, boy, I must be really walking in a, like, you know, clump, you know, strong manner. So I kind of adjusted my footsteps. But this is something that was consistent with practically, I'm doing interviews right now for a book, which I told you about, and very consistent, you know, how Prabhupada's walking was not like other people. So I was going to tell three other, you know, evidences of this, because today we heard the very sad news of the disappearance of Bhakti Vaibhava Puri Maharaj. And in 1971, I was with a group of devotees that went to Vishakhapatnam with Srila Prabhupada to visit the ashram of Bhakti Vaibhava Puri Maharaj. The ashram, I think, was just opening. It was kind of a special occasion. And he had invited Srila Prabhupada and his Western disciples to come. And in the morning, Srila Prabhupada would take a walk on this, by the seashore or the beach. So one morning, I was also on that walk. And I was looking, and I saw where all the devotees were, you know, the water comes in and then goes out, and the sand's like kind of wet. So where all the devotees were stepping, you could see our footprints, and the water would come in, and you'd see the water would fill up in our footprints. But Srila Prabhupada left no footprint at all. And I kept looking, finally, it was Brahmananda Swami, but it was just, I had to tell somebody, look, you know. And he was looking, he saw the same thing. The Prabhupada was not leaving, he was really ecological, he did not leave a footprint. Now they're talking about leaving footprints, you know, on the planet. Well, Prabhupada did not leave a footprint. He was supremely ecological. On another occasion in John Lennon's estate, Jamuna tells the story how she was watching Prabhupada walk through the grass in the morning, and he had these big rubber boots. We used to call them wellies. They were like Wellington, I guess is the name, but we called them wellies. So he had these rubber boots on, and everybody had their wellies, and the grass was very damp in the morning, like sparkling with the silvery dew. So wherever Prabhupada was at the head, and everybody else was behind, and everybody else was left these big marks on the grass. But Jamuna was seeing Prabhupada didn't leave any mark at all. And it was really mystifying. You know, but this is, you know, this has occurred. And then one final occurrence that I just heard in the course of doing these interviews was one devotee made her dandavas, because in the early days, we all did full dandavas. In fact, Srila Prabhupada would order sometimes full dandavas. He stopped one initiation ceremony in Nogamayapur in France. The devotees were just bowing down on their knees. And he stopped. He said, what is this? He said, this is cheating. Full dandavas. And the next person up was one of the ladies. So she heard Prabhupada. She made her full dandavas. Then the devotees told her, and Prabhupada was smiling and nodding his head. Yes, this is one. The right way. That was Ramaniya. Tell me that story. So put in the, got off my tractor. Double thunderbuss. That was brought up because the devotee was made her dandava, right? And Prabhupada was coming. He hadn't come in the room yet, but, you know, he was coming, so they were already down on the floor. And what she didn't notice was that her hands were right in front of the Vyasa sign. And, Ratchachambar. And so then, all of a sudden, Prabhupada was getting up on the Vyasa, and he walked right across his hand. Because her eyes were open, she saw it, but she didn't feel it. Said it was like, she saw his feet were on her hands, but they were so soft. Because it was just like a cloud passing over. And then the next person was one of the sannyasis, and there were quite a few more actually, because she couldn't move, walking on her hands, and she could definitely feel those people walking on her hands. So this is just a little bit, you know, about Prabhupada's, you know, effulgent appearance, his small stature, and his lightness, you know. Then at that same day, we took him, another thing that was funny, but, you know, we had kind of mistaken ideas about what a Swami was. So this was his first time in San Francisco, and, everybody was like following him. Nobody was like showing him the way, you know, through the airport. So we're all following him. And then he went right to the car, you know, and he got in the car. So I was thinking, wow, that's far out. How do you know that, you know? And then later I saw a picture and I realized how he knew it because it was, you know, I'd forgotten this one detail. We had taken a stencil and all over the whole car it said, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. You know? So what I had kind of perceived as a mystical turn wasn't as mystical in retrospect. But he came to the temple, and again the temple was just, there was like no room, you know, for even a piece of paper. It was packed, and there wasn't women on one side, women and men on the other. It was wherever you could find a space and a place, you were. And it was, again, a mixed audience. And the room was filled with fragrances. There was the fragrance of incense. There was the fragrance of, you know, bodies that had been maybe sweating a bit. There was the fragrance of different types of scented perfumes and oils that the hippies were very fond of, particularly patchouli oil. It was just heavy in the room. And then there was all different, you know, people in suits and ties. There were, and hippies like to, you know, dress up in different costumes. Just like the age of Kali was brought in by, you know, this uncouth person who was dressed up like a king. He wasn't a king, but he was dressed up like a king, you know. So hippies, sometimes they like to assume identities, you know, Napoleon or Jesus Christ was a famous character in the hippies. You know, you see three or four of them a day. And, you know, different, you know, Cleopatra or whoever. So here's this room full of really, you know, a bizarre arrangement, you know, of people. And we only had a little wooden platform with a cushion on it. And the cushion, I have to say, we were not so understanding how to treat a pure devotee or even a devotee at all. And we had taken the cushion from a sofa that we found discarded on the street. So it probably wasn't the cleanest thing in the world, but it was free. And that was a big thing in our day, in our lives. So, you know, if we could get it for free, we valued it. So that was there. And he sat down and just, you know, very coolly looked around and picked up Kartal as he started the kirtan. And people joined in very nicely. People joined as best they could. And then he spoke briefly. And I remember not everything, but I do remember the opening statement, because he's speaking to a room that was predominantly hippies. And the hippies had a mantra, just like, you know, we have our Hare Krishna mantra. But the hippies' mantra was, love and peace, brother. They'd go like, you know, love and peace, love and, you know. And it was like, sometimes it was called the love generation. And I think nowadays it probably wouldn't hurt to have a little bit of that mood coming back in the world. But at any rate, that was the mood of the sentiment. And Prabhupada looks around and says, there is no love in this material world. Kind of smashing the whole mythology. And I remember feeling really relieved, because I, you know, being part of that hippie movement, but, you know, not finding the love that we were so desperately seeking, when he said there was no love, it's kind of like, oh, then that's a really, you know, you start doubting yourself, oh, you know, where is it? Why don't I have it? But he didn't leave it on the negative. He then was describing the nature of pure love, and the source of that pure love was coming from Lord Krishna. So it was, for me, very impressionable, because as he was speaking, I was feeling, and in conversations later with others, everyone, I can say, was feeling, emanating from Srila Prabhupada, a type of unconditional love that we had never experienced, even with our own parents. So he was giving this love to us, and in turn, we were falling in love with him. And then the second kirtan, again, after that was the format in those days, kirtan, lecture, little kirtan, everybody chanted really enthusiastically. And Srila Prabhupada's kirtans were not wild out of control. They were very rhythmic. And then right toward the end, he would kind of like very quickly speed up for just a few, you know, a few mantras, and then over, like. So that nice kirtan went on, and then he asked if there was prasad, and somebody brought a tray of cut-up fruit. And he was passing personally to everybody a little piece of fruit. And, you know, later on we began to equate prasad with like big, huge teaching plates of halavan and khichdi and puris and all, you know, like it wasn't prasad unless it was like, you know, really a huge, giant plate. But I can say, just giving that little piece of fruit from the hand of the pure devotee was the most satisfying prasadam. And everybody was feeling completely blissful. There was no other word. Sometimes that blissful word gets kind of overused, but it was completely blissful, and everybody was feeling so satisfied. So that was my first personal contact. Although, in other ways, I had met him through his devotees and through his books. So, in the early days, things happened a little quickly. Things like initiations happened a little quickly. And we were, in that 1 month, he came in about the 17th of January, and we had lined up an event. And the event we had lined up was a fundraiser for our new little storefront temple. And that fundraiser was taking place at a place called the Avalon Ballroom. And the Avalon Ballroom was a, you can say, a den of iniquity. It means a place where everything sinful activities imagined was taking place under the guise of entertainment. And it was one of the two main hot spots for the hippies of the time in San Francisco. And all the bands that were not yet famous but were just about to become very famous would come there and play their music, which in retrospect was pretty torturous music. It wasn't too, you know, it wasn't very pleasant really type of sound, but everybody loved it. And so we thought, well, we'll bring Swamiji there, we'll arrange, you know, a program there, and he can bring the mantra there. So that way we'll reach a lot of people. This was the idea. And at the same time, we can raise some funds to start our project. So we had, myself and my husband at the time, Chen Sundar, had been integrated in the music scene, so we knew some of these people, and we asked them if they would donate their, you know, their playing their music that night. You know, they would do, it would do a what do they call benefit. So they agreed, and so we had this was the original mantra rock dance. And Srila Prabhupada did come. He didn't spend the whole evening, of course, but I remember his entry, because the place was just in full swing. You couldn't barely see through the smoke, and most of the smoke was coming from, I hate to say it, from marijuana. The hippies, they kind of like that particular herbal product. And they had very intense light shows. These light shows were like, you would get these colored lights, and you'd put them on some kind of a circuit, so they would flash at different decibels, and it would become what we used to call psychedelic. I mean, it was just, you couldn't see things normally, so it was like being high without a drug. So they had the lights that were making everybody's mind kind of wig out, plus all the, you know, LSD and the marijuana, and then all these bands. And in this situation, and plus people were doing all kinds of other activities together in, you know, wherever they wanted in the place, men and women together, all tangled up. So enter Srila Prabhupada with his little group of brahmacharis. And he came out on the stage, and I remember I was up in a little balcony, and the spotlight came down on him, and Allen Ginsberg was there, and he introduced him. And Prabhupada told Allen Ginsberg he should first chant, because they all knew him. And Allen Ginsberg wanted Srila Prabhupada to chant. So they both chanted, but I remember seeing Srila Prabhupada, and I felt like I wanted to protect him, because all of a sudden, you know, maybe just a couple of weeks ago, that whole scene would have been totally normal to my eyes and to my senses. But just after just, you know, a couple of weeks in the presence of such a magnificent personality, Srila Prabhupada, I could now see how degraded and how disgusting and just, you know, how frightening that whole atmosphere was. So when I saw Srila Prabhupada there on the stage in that spotlight and all around in the darkness with all the weird stuff going on, I felt like, you know, I was feeling like I needed to protect him, but I didn't know how, and I was up in that balcony. Anyway, he chanted, and he spoke a few words, but he could understand this was not the type of audience to give a lecture to, so just the chanting, and then he left. And then I was coming down, and I met him and the group of the devotees, and Prabhupada, he paused, and he turned around, and he looked, and he goes, "This is no place for a brahmachari." So, yeah, social commentary. But the next day, he called Shamsundar, and he goes, "So Shamsundar, how much money did we make?" Prabhupada was very practical. He goes, "I don't know, off ophthalmology," because I was the one at the door, because I was very tenacious about, you know, hippies, they didn't like to spend, you know, everything should be free, you know. But we were charging money, and I mean, you had to pay, so I was, like, making sure everybody paid. So, you know, Prabhupada, then he turned to Shamsundar, and he said, "So do you know how to keep accounts? I mean, and, you know, your hippie lifestyle, who kept an account? You just, you know, there was no accounting, you just spent it if you had it." But then Shamsundar knew a little bit, so then Prabhupada said, "Come here," and he sat down, and he told him, he showed him how to keep an account, and he made Shamsundar the first treasurer of the San Francisco temple. That was one of the things. Then we had the first initiation, which was probably this, I think it was like the third initiation in this time. And there were five of us who were going to be initiated. And out of the five of us, none of us had seen an initiation before. And only maybe three or four of the devotees, Mukunda, of course, and Janaki had seen, because they were initiated, and a couple of the people had, you know, because they were initiated, they'd seen the initiation. So they gave a list to me, and they said I had to get these items, and they had a list. I had to get some sticks of wood, I had to get some bricks, some sand, and some butter, and some bananas, and some matches. an instance. So this is what you needed to get initiated. And so, you know, and gathered it together. And I remember asking him, what's the butter for? And they told me that it was going to go in the fire. And I just looked at the guy and said, what a waste. You know? So he had no concept of, you know, of yajna, of offering, no idea what was going to happen. Anyway, we got it. And that initiation, what we knew that, even though we didn't understand exactly what was going to happen, what we did know is that we were going to take vows, irrevocable vows, and that we would get a new name. And from that day on, it was like a new life. So we were set up in a little line, and one side to the Prabhupada and the other, and the devotees were all sitting around, and Prabhupada told them they should chant. So the mantra was being chanted, and then the fire had started, and, you know, we got our names, which we could barely understand. Our neckties in those days were just some wooden beads that we had strung together. We got them at a hobby shop. There was no tulsi available. Our chanting beads, we strung them ourselves, again, from pine wood. And in those days, for some reason, we were bright red beads, brown beads. So part of getting initiated was the ceremony of stringing your beads. So we got new names, we got these neckties. In those days, we didn't have a little screw, we tied them on. They were going to stay on for life. And that was indicating also the vows and this new step into life, you know, that you tied on these beads. And we called them Swamiji's dog collar. But now we were becoming his, you know, his humble little dog. And I remember the beads were getting around my neck, and I looked out toward the door and I thought, as soon as these beads are on, that's it. I can't change. So there's still time. The knot hasn't been tied. My mind quickly went like that. And I just said, no, I have to stay. So then just then the knot was tied. So then we got our name, which most of us couldn't quite be sure about what it was exactly, but we had our new name. We did the fire. The room just like filled up. You couldn't even barely see Prabhupada across from the smoke. And then after it was over, at one point they handed us the banana, and we didn't know what to do with the banana, so we started to peel it. And then the devotee had to tell us, no, go to the fire, you know. And then Prabhupada was telling, bow down. And as mentioned yesterday, initially Prabhupada's accent is, you know, a little difficult. And this was particularly more so in the very beginning days, when his accent was not only, you know, was heavier. As he spent more time in the West and, you know, preached and lectured in English, his accent became less pronounced. And also he learned certain Western expressions, because otherwise his accent was quite, you know, early 1900s British accent type of, you know, mixed with Bengali. So we didn't understand Bodon, you know, and he was going like this. And we're kind of seeing that through the smoke, and the five of us would kind of look to each other. And then the person who was going to be our temple president, his name was Harvey Cohen, and he just became Haridas. He figured it out, he thought. He got down on his hands and knees, and we also did, and then he leaned forward and he started blowing on the fire. So the rest of us got on our knees, and we all leaned forward and we started blowing on the fire. And then I remember looking up, and I see through the Prabhupada's face, through the smoke, and his eyes were really big. Now, you know, if you think about it, Srila Prabhupada is always associating with Krishna. And Krishna does really fantastic things, like, you know, lift an entire mountain with his little finger, you know, swallow a fire, you know, crack a big bird's beak. You know, what can we do that's really, you know, so far out? So, most of the time we could, you know, if we had an expression in those days, we'd say, if something was really, like we considered this was really something really far out, we'd say, oh, that, you know, that really blew my mind. So that was a common expression. Well, nothing would really blow Swamiji's mind. You know, we were quite ordinary, you know, compared to what he was used to, you know, all these fantastic activities associated with Krishna. But every once in a while, we would do something that would just, you know, he would just kind of look at us like. So that day, it was a big eye, and he could clearly see we didn't get it. So he just like picked up the card calls, and he just started the kirtan. And then later, we were informed about what it was we were supposed to have done, which was bow down. But we didn't even know that. So this is kind of giving an indication of, as I mentioned yesterday, about Srila Prabhupada's mercy, this all-encompassing mercy that was just there immediately from the beginning, and compassion for very fallen and conditioned souls. Not that we should always remain in that condition, but to get us up off the ground, he was incredibly tolerant, incredibly merciful, and, you know, incredibly compassionate. Another story to illustrate this was from that same era. After Lord Jagannath was discovered, and he had asked Kamsundar to carve him large, so this was like another historical thing, because up until this time there was no deity worship going on in our little Islam society, which consisted of two little storefront temples, one in New York and one in San Francisco. So Shamsundar was carving what was going to become the first deities in Islam. And he hadn't totally conquered a particular habit that he had, which was that he was smoking. So one day there was a knock, knock, knock on the door of our apartment. I answered the door, and there was Swamiji with a couple of the other boys, and he said, "I've come to check on Chamsundar." He wanted to see how the work was progressing, because he had told us he had initially planned to leave to go back to New York, but he said he would remain in San Francisco until the deities, Lord Jagannath, was finished, the carving was done. So Chamsundar was actually going a little slow in the carving, because he knew that Prabhupada would stay there. So he wanted to take as much time as he could to keep Prabhupada in San Francisco. So Srila Prabhupada came, and he looked in, and he seen the three figures were there, you know, the outline, the rough outline. And all of a sudden, he looked, and Subhadra, he lifts up his cane. What is that? And there was a little box on her head. And that little box said Marlboro. I suppose you all know what Marlboro is? The brand of tobacco. So Prabhupada, he looks at that, he goes, and he flips it. He took his cane and he flips it off. And he goes, yeah. He goes, no, he didn't become angry. He wasn't even extremely disgusted. He was actually very compassionate. He goes, yes, it is very difficult to give up this smoking habit. And then he looked, just his look was penetrating to Shamsundar. He says, but don't let such a small thing as a stick of tobacco, and he goes like this, don't let such a small thing as a stick of tobacco stand between you and Krishna. So instead of chastising him, you nonsense, he said, what are you doing? He just, you know, gave him this wonderful instruction. Don't let the small thing. Then he said, yes, it's very difficult. He said, therefore, smoke. And again he didn't say, okay, just cut it out. Don't ever do that again. No, he said, no. You smoke one less each day until finished. So he gave a very, you know, he was telling him, it's not good, you shouldn't do this. Don't let this stand between you and Krishna. At the same time, recognizing the struggle his devotee was going through, so he gave him a practical detox. Instead of going to the rehab, he just said, one less every day until finished. And Shamsundar did that. So this was Srila Prabhupada's wonderfully compassionate way to deal with the difficulties that his early disciples were facing. He was also very wonderfully compassionate to all kinds of visitors and guests who would come. one time this one couple came, and they were very supportive because they had jobs, which most of us didn't have, like regular jobs, so we didn't have like a regular income, so we kind of never knew where the next penny was coming from. And this couple had a job, and they liked the way the devotees were giving free food, free prasadam, every day. So they would donate every month a big bag of rice, big bag of flour, so that we could, you know, have our food program, the prasadam program. And one day they invited Srila Prabhupada to come to their house for brunch. So brunch is like before, it's after breakfast and before lunch, kind of in between. I think the British call it tiffin. And Prabhupada accepted to go. And so Prabhupada and a few of us went, and they had quite a nice place on Portrero Hill. It was overlooking the bay, very scenic view. So they, you know, they opened the door, they showed the view, and then they had a very nice long wooden table. And on the table there were just three bowls and some glasses. So the bowl had, one bowl had strawberries, the next bowl had some whipping cream that was all beat up, so it was a little fluffy, and the next bowl had some brown sugar in it, and there were no plates. So we all sat down, we were invited to sit down, Srila Prabhupada sat down, and so they could see we weren't quite sure what to do, so they said, we'll show you, and they took one strawberry and they dipped it in the cream and then in the sugar, and then they, you know, and then I thought they would offer it to Prabhupada, and then they took a bite, so they indicated that's how we should also do this. And then they took another one, they dip, and then they handed it to the Prabhupada. So he accepted. There was no special plate, no special bowls for him. You know, we didn't know these things at that point. Again, the Prabhupada accepted what was coming with love and obviously with ignorance, but he accepted it. And there was one other point about this couple, that it was actually two men. It was two boys, two men. They were like homosexual couple. And Prabhupada, you know, he didn't comment one way or the other, but he accepted their service because he could see if anyone was eligible to be purified if they served Krishna or the pure devotee. So it was another example of his wonderful compassion. Srila Prabhupada had very, very affectionate relationship with all of his early devotees because there weren't so many of us. So, like in the later days, you hear, you know, how people literally couldn't get to see him in a personal darshan. It wasn't possible because, in fact, there would be guards at the door. I've met some of those guards, actually. But in the early days, it didn't happen. You know, there was a handful of us. We could just go up and knock on the door. And we would, and we did. If we had a question or we wanted to know something, we could go knock on his door, and he would answer it and answer our questions. So between his female disciples and the male disciples, there was very much interaction, very much affection and dealings. And in particular, his first lady disciple, her name was Janaki Devi Dasi, and she was married to Mukunda Das Bhattacharya at the time, who's now Mukunda Maharaj. But Janaki was extremely gregarious, and she just loved Swamiji unabashedly. Just no, you know, she just loved him. And she would do little things very spontaneously that she would think this would please him. She would do them. Like one time she made his lunch, and there was a little paper parasol that I think they make them in China or Japan. And usually you see these little parasols in like maybe a bar. They make a drink and they stick this parasol in the drink. I don't know the name of the drink, but you know. But anyway, she had got them and she decorated it and she made the plate and she stuck these little parasols on the plate. So a little, you know, the parasol is like a little umbrella, but it's made of paper and it has some little flowers on it. They're maybe just like about this big, and on a very little thin stick. And she had a few of them on his plate, and she brought the plate to him. And he looked, and he smiled, and he said, yes. He said, Radharani knew the art of serving Krishna so nicely that simply by glancing, he was fully satisfied. So that was so wonderful. And then on another time, he called her, and he says he had made something, and he said, "Try this." So she tried it, and he said, "So what do you think?" And she goes, "Swami, it is simply wonderful." And he goes, "Yeah." And if anybody recognizes the name, Simply Wonderful, they became an institution unto the institution. Prabhupada had been experimenting with powdered milk, powdered sugar, and butter. And Janaki's response became the name of that particular preparation that, you know, we're all familiar with. And then another one was that she was experimenting, and she made some whipped cream because she saw from that day, because he'd eaten strawberries and whipped cream, she thought he liked the whipped cream. So she took some whipped cream and some cooked rice, and she cut up some fruit and mixed that in. And then she brought it to him, and he tasted it, and he seemed to like it, and he says, "What is this?" And she hadn't thought about it before, she just put it together. So she goes, "It's Krishna's surprise." And if you look in some of the early cookbooks, the first cookbook we have, you'll see Krishna's surprise. You know. And then later on they started using yogurt instead of whipped cream, but at any rate that was another occurrence that occurred between Janaki and Sri Prabhupada. And then another time she brought him an artichoke. I don't know how many people here know what an artichoke is. Kind of have to know what an artichoke is to appreciate this. An artichoke is like a type of vegetable. It's about this big, and it's all packed up. Like if you saw a lotus that hadn't opened up, but like with many, many more leaves. So that's like an artichoke, but it never opens up. It has all these leaves. And you peel it off the leaf one by one, and usually you dip it in some kind of a sauce, and then you put it in your mouth and you scrape your teeth, and there's a little fleshy part at the end. They're very tasty. And it's a very, once you've got all the leaves, there's a portion called the artichoke heart, and that's the big delicacy. So she brings the artichoke to him, and she's very excited. She was always excited when she was bringing something new. And he was so affectionate with her. In fact, in one letter to Jamuna, he'd written the letter, and at the end he wrote, "And how is Janaki, my naughty daughter?" So they were sisters. And another letter to Janaki says, he says, "I do not mind if I say your sister is somewhat better than you." Anyway, so he's looking at the artichoke, and he didn't have any idea what to do. So she showed him what to do. And he's looking at it, and he says, "So much trouble." Which is true, it's a lot of trouble to eat an artichoke. So that was probably the last time he had an artichoke. And then one other pastime was actually recorded on camera. So there's a series of these shots, and you see Prabhupada looking over his shoulder, and there's Mukunda Maharaj, and there's another devotee whose name is Rishikesh, and another devotee whose name is Devananda. Rishikesh is still around, Devananda's left his body. And then Hiragriva, and even Trikananda, different ones. So there's like kind of a wooden railing. Prabhupada's sitting down, looking over his shoulder, and there's one girl kind of holding something up in her like this, with kind of an impy smile. And then there's Mukunda there. So this is Janaki. Prabhupada's at the airport. He's waiting for the plane, you know, to be called to check in. And, you know, of course, we didn't want him to go. And Janaki in particular was very very adamant that he should stay. She really didn't want him to go. So he's sitting there like this, holding his ticket, and she comes from behind and she grabs the ticket out. Just like the monkeys come from behind and get your glasses, she got Prabhupada's ticket, and she's holding it up, and he turns, and he sees that Janaki has the ticket. And his eyes, he's looking at her, and then he's also looking at Mukunda, because he wasn't sure, like, knowing Janaki, anything could happen. You know, she might just tear it up or something, you know, so he's kind of looking at Mukunda, "What do I do?" And she goes, "Now you can't go. I have your ticket." So that was a very, very affectionate exchanges, you know. You know, like, you think, I was thinking of this, that we were all from wherever we were situated, wherever our consciousness was, be pushed up by Srila Prabhupada. You know, some people would come in, they'd already had some experience with some kind of yoga, this or that, and they would come and sit down in front of Prabhupada and, you know, in some kind of very formal posture, and they would ask some very deep questions. But these very, very affectionate exchanges between Prabhupada and his early disciples were very deep, because they submitted the heart with love that could never be removed. And whether or not you see these disciples here in front of you today or otherwise, that loving affection in their hearts for Srila Prabhupada is irrevocably present. And if you speak to any of them, no matter what their condition is currently, you will find that. So many secrets and wonderful treasures are in their hearts in these early days. Anyway, we had the idea that we should maybe try to promote, you know, Swamiji's presence. We had the big Avalon ballroom dance, so we could understand that, you know, although there's a lot of people in these kind of places, it's not the best place to try to preach Krishna consciousness. So we had the idea, well, let's rent a big place, and then we'll fill it up with people who are interested in spiritual life. So we rented this beautiful church. It was Universal Unitarian Church, and even to this day, in many places, we have very good relationships. This church is kind of funny, because they don't really have a particular... You can believe whatever you want. You don't even have to believe in God to be a member of this church. They believe in open expression and open freedom for searching. So they're very open, you know, to other practices. Actually, in Columbus, Ohio, right now the temple is too small for the congregation. So on Sunday, their Sunday feast is held in the Universal Unitarian Church, which has a very nice big place. Anyway, so we rented this church and advertised, you know, posters everywhere, all over town, you know. And we thought, boy, this is going to be great, packed out. And hardly anybody came. Was really just the regular people that came to the temple. You know, a few hippies that came, and, you know, a few people, you know, but was basically empty. Prabhupada came in, sat down, and he just, you know, thunderbolt lecture. You're not this body, and the need for spreading Krishna, you know, picking up Krishna consciousness. And then afterwards, he looked around and asked, are there any questions? And there was this young man who'd been coming. We'd met him at the Morning Star Ranch, which was another episode. So he raised his hand, and he said, well, you know, if I take to this process, but I don't finish it, if I'm not successful, you know, what happens? So Prabhupada, he liked that question very much. He thought this was coming from an intelligent person. And so he gave a very nice answer. You know, Arjuna had the same question, you know. But not to worry, that it's just like in the material world, you have your bank account. If you put money in, it's okay. But if you start to take it out, you will lose. You know, he says that your spiritual bank account, there is no loss. You cannot lose. Whatever you put in, it remains. And then in your next life, you simply continue from that point. There is no loss. So then he says, is that okay? And the young man was very satisfied. So later on, this young man, his name was Tom Herzik, he became Kamal Krishna Das Goswami. So that was a, you know, a very nice moment, very nice. And then on the way back, we're in the car, a few of us are in the car, and Govinda Dasi in particular was just feeling, you know, we were feeling a little bad that the place hadn't packed out and it had been such a little small audience. So Govinda Dasi says, you know, he tried to apologize, I'm sorry to the Prabhupada, and nobody came, and he turned around, he was in the front seat, he goes, oh, you did not see Narada Muni was there, or Brahma was there, you did not see? And no, we didn't see. But Srila Prabhupada saw that they had come to hear the pure devotee speak. And there was apparently at least one or two other occasions where he made that same statement, maybe under different conditions, but at least we could understand that the demigods were interested in the activities of the pure devotee. And speaking of pure devotees, on the morning walk, Upendra asked Srila Prabhupada, he was, Swamiji, are there any other devotees like you on the planet? And probably, are there any other pure devotees? And so one other devotee asked, and then Prabhupada turns to Upendra. I forget who asked it. He goes, Upendra, how many of us are there? So at that point, he says, about 75. Then Prabhupada turns to the person who asked the question being how many, are there other pure devotees? He goes, about 75. So, you can imagine what level of pure devotees we were. However, nonetheless, Prabhupada took us to be pure devotees, that we had given up our sinful activities to attempt to serve Lord Krishna. Automatically, you're in the platform of pure devotee. What level of pure devotee was another thing. But this was actually very instructive, and it was also a very heavy lesson, because we kind of realized that there was something to this, that there was some obligation here on our part. But this was also very sweet, that he had so much confidence in it. And he had such lack of ego. He could have very well said, I'm the only pure devotee on the planet. We would have accepted that. But there was none of that in him whatsoever. And that was another lesson, was his humility. Well, so I just noticed it is 7 o'clock. Time for the Arti of Shri Radha Shamsudra. So thank you for your time, and may all of you remember and be blessed by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.